Welcome to our panel on relationships. I'm Michelle Hoover. And you're here for a real treat. These are excellent. Well, I personally think that fiction is the best form of art on the planet. And now we have, three fabulous fiction writers. We're going to start off with, afterwards, just remember that if you like what they read, their books will be available downstairs to buy afterwards. It's really nice, the idea of being a starving artist, but it doesn't work very well, so it's nice to buy their books. So think about that. Just ponder it, you know, in your goodness. So Annie Weatherwax is going to start first. Annie Weatherwax's stories have appeared in The Sun magazine, The Southern Review, and elsewhere. She is the 2009 winner of the Robert Olin Butler Prize for Fiction and has written for The New York Times. She's a graduate of the Rhode Island School of Design. For years, she earned a living sculpting superheroes and cartoon characters for Nickelodeon, DC Comics, Pixar, and others. She is currently a full-time painter and writer. Robert Olin Butler called her novel All We Had an unflinchingly honest and brilliantly voiced book. He went on, quote, her other artistic persona as a visual artist has made her an instant expert at one of the most challenging but fundamental skills of a fiction writer, the ability to render the moment-to-moment sensual there-ness of a scene. Welcome, Annie.
Thank you very much. It's such an honor to be here and to be reading with these two incredible writers. I'm going to read from the beginning of the book, and chapter one is called Grit. Phil's kitchen was littered with crap. A rotisserie chicken from the convenience store down the street sat at the center of his table. It glistened and shimmered with fat as it teetered unevenly on a pile of old papers. It was June 2005. I was 13. My mother had just lost one of her part-time jobs at Walgreens, and another landlord was threatening to kick us out. So with her movie star looks and Oscar-worthy acting, voila, out of nowhere she produced Phil, an instant boyfriend with a place to live. It was my least favorite of her acts, but it always worked. It was over 95 degrees that day in Orange, California. The breeze from the fan in the window traveled up the chicken's spine, and the remains of a few feathers quivered. Phil sat next to my mother across from me. He reached forward, yanked off a drumstick, and the entire arrangement shook. "Mmm, I just love chicken," he drawled, biting off a piece. I hated all my mother's boyfriends. Uniformly, they were jerks. This one, I decided, may also have some brain damage. A 1-800 next day wall-to-wall carpet installer, Phil claimed he could have a one-bedroom house totally carpeted in under 2 hours. He talked about his job as if he were a paramedic. People need carpeting. It's important, he'd explained, and for some, it's urgent. Except for a trophy of thinning hair coiffed and perched on the front of his head, Phil was bald. He had a big, bushy beard, and his mustache grew all the way over his mouth. It squirmed on his upper lip when he chewed. It was gross. He lived on the first floor of a run-down building on MacArthur Boulevard. His apartment smelled like carpet glue. Dark paneling was everywhere, and half the ceiling was coming down. "Oh, honey," my mother patted Phil's arm as if he were a baby, "I'm so glad you like the chicken." You'd never know it by the way she was acting with him, but my mother was fierce and smart. She could spot an asshole from 1,000 miles away, and her favorite word by far was fuck. "I like them earrings, too," Phil gestured, nodding and pointing his chicken leg in her direction. "They go real good with your dress." She clutched her chest in a soap opera swoon. I'd seen this act a million times before. If I had to classify it, I'd call it phony melodrama, and every man my mother ever dated fell for it. My mother finished her oogling and got up to use the bathroom. With the chicken leg in his hand, Phil stretched out his arm, yawned loudly, and showed his crooked yellow teeth. A truck whizzed by. The house shook, and a sprinkle of plaster drifted down from the ceiling like snow. Phil gazed around with a dull look and went on chewing. I eyed him across the table. "Psst," I whispered. He closed his mouth and looked at me. "Yeah," he said. I moved closer, pulled my glasses down my nose, and looked him in the eye. "You ever hit a woman?" I asked. "No, ma'am." He tugged on his beard nervously. "Never hit a one." I squinted my eyes lower. "Well, if you ever hit my mother, I'm gonna set your beard on fire and watch you burn to the ground." My mother said I was born knowing exactly what to say and do. It was a gift she didn't have. Phil looked good and worried now. He picked his napkin up and wiped his forehead. I withdrew. I pushed my glasses up and sat back in my seat. "Know what happened to the last guy who hit her?" I asked. "No, ma'am," he pulled on his beard again. "He's dead," I stated matter-of-factly, stabbing my last piece of chicken with my fork. One of my mother's ex-boyfriends was in fact dead, but not because I set him on fire. He died in a car crash with whiskey on his breath. "And one other thing," I added, "the bathroom is gross. Clean up your overspray and put the seat down when you're done." He burped. When his mustache vibrated, he seemed surprised to feel it move. He wiped his mouth, put his napkin down, and looked at me. "Fair enough," was all he said, smiling. It sent shivers up my spine. Clearly, Phil was an axe murderer. He probably had a freezer full of body parts hidden in a storage unit somewhere. I searched his place for drugs and firearms. I was sure he had kiddie porn stashed inside a drawer, but I didn't find a thing. He didn't drink or yell, and he went on saying nice things about my mother, about her hair, her eyes, her makeup, her clothes. But Phil did not fool me. No matter how they started, all my mother's boyfriends turned into assholes. It was only a matter of time before he did, too. 5 nights later, I was lying in bed when I heard a floorboard squeak. I listened and waited, but nothing happened. The day had never cooled. The air was dry and hot. The only window faced the street. The corner pane was boarded up. The plumbing clattered. A speeding car outside left a whoosh, and a smattering of shadows spun across the walls. Then one by one, footsteps in the hall got closer. When my door creaked open, my throat seized. A shadow loomed in the doorway and blocked out all the light. With Alfred Hitchcock lighting and the theme from Jaws hammering in my head, I waited for the axe to rise. I opened my mouth to let out a blood-curdling scream. In a perfect finale, it would echo on through the night. But then I heard a sigh. "Push over," my mother said to me. "I can't sleep." When life was just me and her, it felt like magic. When we slept, we fit together like spoons. We'd start out with her arm wrapped around me, and in the middle of the night, like clockwork, we'd switch. It made no difference where. We could be sleeping in an alley or on a single cot, but we never crowded each other or pulled the covers off, no matter how small they were. Phil, according to her, snored, but I knew what was really going on. She missed our late-night conversations like she always did. That night, she chit-chatted like nothing was wrong. She repeated several episodes of Roseanne verbatim. Normally, when she did this, it made me crazy. But I missed her, too. So I laughed at all the right parts and hung on her every word. Finally, after two nights, she dropped the charade and started talking about what was really on her mind. Phil likes kissing too much, and his penis is small. My mother never treated me like some stupid kid. We told each other everything, but this topic made me want to kill myself. From what she'd said, the penis, I'd decided, was like a dim-witted, dangerous child growing between the leg. But I knew when it was best to just listen. In exchange for her confidence, I remained neutral. I'm thinking about leaving him, she finally said one night. And even though I wanted to shout, Halla-fucking-luya, I maintained my cool and nodded, expressionless. If I didn't, it could backfire. Like a stray cat, one false move and she'd be gone. But I got tired of waiting. So when Phil was on a carpet call, I took a gamble and made my move. I packed my stuff into two garbage bags and dragged them into the kitchen. My mother was there cooking, not in the way she usually did, by sticking already cooked things in plastic containers into the microwave and pressing high. She was actually wearing an apron, chopping something and trying to use the stove. Phil had a crappy little TV with a coat hanger antenna jammed in the corner of the kitchen counter, and Wheel of Fortune, her favorite, was on. The image was fuzzy and blurry. It made the wheel look oblong. A plump lady in a plum dress took hold of the shape and spun it around. She bounced up and down and brought her small hands together in quick staccato clapettes. I cleared my throat. My mother finally turned and saw me, the knife limp in her hand. I was tomboyish and rough around the edges, but she was classically beautiful. She had emerald eyes, flawlessly arched eyebrows, full lips, and a perfect figure. And she moved with natural grace, no matter how bad the conditions were around her. But my mother was tired. She had me when she was 16, and even though she was now only 29, worry lines were beginning to define her face. In this light, her eyes were dull. The hints of gold in her light brown hair looked flat and dark. Her hair was up with her favorite tortoise shell clip, but the clip had come loose and her hair was spilling out. She reached up and tucked a strand back in. Her eyes slowly traveled down my arm and rested on my bags, but she ignored me. She turned away, picked her cigarette up off the edge of the counter, took a drag, and started chopping again. Come on, Mom, I pleaded. We can go somewhere nice, like the beach. We were only 20 minutes from the ocean, but we'd hardly ever been. We could get beef tacos, the crispy kind with extra cheese. I knew that's how she liked them. There was more clapping on TV because someone bought a vowel. My mother looked to see which one. Ding, 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 ding. Vanna White turned over five E's. Come on, Mom, I said again. My mother raised a finger, 1 minute, please, as she sounded out the clue. One flew over the cuckoo's nest, I said. It was such a standard on this show. You know, she said, then turned and glared at me. I really hate it when you do that. I almost had it. Well, I'm leaving. Are you coming or not? But she didn't answer. She picked up the knife. Chop, chop, chop. Mom, I stamped my foot. I heard you. She slapped the knife down and turned around to look at me. You think I like it here any more than you do? Well, I don't. But I don't have a job, and we have. Let me add it up. She looked at the ceiling and pretended to calculate. No money. So what? I said. I failed to see what else was new. We have no money, she enunciated loudly and slowly as if I were deaf, then picked up her cigarette and sucked on the end of it so hard the hollows of her cheek caved in. Fine, I shrieked. I'll go by myself. I grabbed my bags and dragged them towards the door. Usually, our fights escalated rapidly until we were shouting the single word jerk back and forth at each other as if we were married. But this time, there was silence. The only sound was the tick, tick, tick of the knife on the chopping board. My hand is on the doorknob, I yelled. I'm turning it. I'm pulling the door open. Have a nice life. Goodbye. Adios. A truck sped by in front of me. An empty Bud can rattled along the curb behind it. A cloud of exhaust and the bitter smell of gasoline lingered in the street. The sun felt hot enough to burn the earth to ashes. The air was so stifling, I could barely breathe. My eyes fell out of focus. The city sounds of traffic moaned and slowed until I could barely hear them. But the sound of my mother's knife on the cutting board grew louder. My tactics usually worked, but I feared today they wouldn't. I took a step out the door, flap, flap, flap. In the other room, the wheel of fortune spun around. We had planned our whole lives out together. We dreamed someday we'd own a house. My version of it was always yellow with black shutters for contrast. A custom-made welcome mat would sit in front of the door with our names, Ruthie and Rita Carmichael, written in script at an angle. In my mother's version, the house was white and our names were written on the mailbox. But we both agreed our house would sit back from the road on a corner at a pleasing angle, and we'd have a pool. Bye, I swallowed. I started to close the door behind me when her chopping stopped. A long moment passed. Wait, she finally called. I'm coming.
Nice. Thank you. That's wonderful.
Thank you.
So again, our panel is on relationships, which includes people that we want to set on fire. I like that. Hester Kaplan will be reading next. She is the author of The Edge of Marriage, which won the Flannery O'Connor Award for Short Fiction. Also the book Kinship Theory and The Tell. She has won a National Endowment for the Arts Fellowship, and she's on the faculty of Lesley University's MFA program in creative writing. Booklist referred to her collection Unravished as offering readers a notably perceptive, spare, and acutely written stories. And Roxana Robinson, who's one of my favorites, called her stories lovely. She said they're smart, thoughtful, beautiful, and wise. And then she ran out of adjectives, I think. Full of the small but important illuminations we need as we make our way through our lives. Welcome, Hester Kaplan.
Thank you. This is a great panel and really so exciting to be here. And I just want to say, Phil may be a sort of jerk, but any guy who can carpet a house for $200 probably deserves a second look. I'm gonna read, just sort of jump into a long story called This Is Your Last Swim, and I gotta give you just a teeny little bit of run-up. What you really need to know about it is that the end of the world has been announced. No big deal, but the world is gonna end. And the characters are Mimi, who's a dean of students at a private boarding school on a large campus, and she thinks she's entirely alone. Everybody has left after the announcement. So she's now in the dining hall looking for something to eat before the world ends, which is what most of us would probably do. She detected footsteps again, unmistakable now. Her wits were as acute as cavities touched by tinfoil. She felt the footfalls, soft-soled and intent, in her throat, and she dropped under the table. The steps halted just outside the dining hall door and then came in. some shifting, the menace of the indecisive, a few more steps and a squeaky stop. She saw the shoes, brilliant white, decades-old Reeboks, pale freckled ankles, the bottoms of stiff blue jean capris, peds with yellow fuzzy balls. "Who's here?" the voice demanded. "Show yourself." Always with that fucking ridiculous tone of authority, that air of unimpeachability, incredible that she couldn't let it drop even now, it was the head of school, Pat Neeland. "Who's there under the table? Come out right now," Pat said. "Do you hear me? Come out." Mimi unfolded up but stayed kneeling. "Pat," she said, offering her hands open in surrender. "It's me. It's just me." Pat's face pinched. "Mimi," she said, "what are you doing here?" "That's an interesting question," Mimi said and gazed at the rafters. She deeply disliked the woman. "Let's see. I don't know," she said. "Maybe proctoring the SATs? Pat's makeup was cakey, and for Christ's sake, why makeup at all now? And cracked as she disapproved. "What I mean," Pat said, is why aren't you at home? People claimed the woman read up on effective communication techniques in her spare time, but if she did, she'd missed all the important nuances, like warmth, like a subtle touch, like humility, like elasticity. She was a blunt tool, a solid instrument. "Someone stole my car," Mimi lied. The truth is, she'd handed the keys to a terrified boy and wondered now if he even knew how to drive. "Who stole your car?" Pat demanded. "No, it doesn't matter," she said, "though hard to imagine that one of our students would do that." What was hard to imagine was that they found themselves two women with a wary, distrustful affiliation here together. The underside of Pat's chin was exposed like the belly of a cat, soft to touch maybe, but potentially an incitement to bite. "I thought I was the only one here," Mimi said. "I assumed you'd gone home too." "Home," Pat said. "I happen to live here, as I have for the past 16 years. "Yes, I know," Mimi said, "but I thought family maybe, or friends somewhere else." Her conjecture felt cruel, but she wasn't sorry. Pat's brittle, almost translucent reddish hair was flattened on one side as though she'd been lying on it for days. Her face was not unpretty, but it wasn't beautiful either. Handsome was what Mimi's father would have said. At 63, she was efficient and smooth, like a ball-peen hammer. "You hungry?" Mimi asked. Pat pulled out a chair. She gave the pudding and bread a distasteful glance. "That's all you could find?" Mimi hated that everything the woman said sounded like a scold. "You'd prefer vanilla, maybe?" she asked. Pat put her hands flat on the table. "I'd prefer not being in this situation at all, if you must know." As if Pat were the only fucking one in it, as if this could all be blamed on someone's ineptitude. "Well, yes, there's that," Mimi said. "Me too." "Actually, I think I would," Pat said. "Prefer vanilla, that is." Mimi went back to the kitchen, got another giant spoon and tin of pudding, but hesitated at the swinging doors. She'd always been uneasy around Pat, resentful for sure, but wasn't it absurd to feel that way now? Why the pretense of a pecking order anymore, the self-censorship, the acquiescing? Mimi wasn't going to be asked to, quote, consider what she wanted to do with her career, which was school speak for "you're shit canned, you're dead to us." She handed Pat the spoon. The woman turned to the window every few seconds. "So," Mimi asked, "how are you doing?" She saw the skin bunch at the back of Pat's post-menopausal hands. "Ask me a better question," Pat said. "Like, why are you so damn chilly?" Mimi thought. "Like, why do you need to put people on edge? Like, why is it still okay for you to lord?" Because here was the problem, that hard, humorless front that made you want to back away even now, when Pat was, for the time being, the only other last person on earth. "A better question," Mimi said. There was only one question left: how will it all end? But she wouldn't ask it. Pat could never soothe her. Pat dipped a tip of the spoon into the pudding. She deposited a dollop onto her tongue and then turned to the window again. What are you looking for? Mimi asks. What's out there? I've never really enjoyed pudding, the texture of it, Pat said, putting down the spoon. Slimy stuff. Oh, to be stuck with anyone but this woman. Who the hell didn't like pudding? At the start of every year, before the students arrived, when the excruciating faculty and staff icebreakers and team-building exercises were in full mandatory force, tug-of-war, scavenger hunts, everything but circle jerks, Pat participated wearing the same pair of goofy pants and these same antiquated sneakers. She'd approach tug-of-war like a heartless surgeon, whisking her hands together when her team yanked the other across the line and onto their knees in the dirt, and then she'd feasted on a Diet Coke. How about some bread? Mimi asked and pushed a loaf towards her. She wanted to grab more of the soft innards and roll them into balls, but held herself back. Shame, shame, it rushed at her as hot as the first time she'd been caught doing this. She clasped her hands together. Or would you rather have whole wheat, she asked. I'm not concerned about my fiber intake at the moment, Pat said, and unwound the bread's crust. Was that actually a glimmer of humor, Mimi wondered. I saw you walking around earlier, Pat said, and the day before. I thought I was alone, Mimi said. I know you did, the way you kept looking behind you. I was in the residence. So you were watching me? Mimi asked. I wasn't watching you. I was looking out, and you came into view. Look there, Pat said, and pointed to a fluster of birds gathered on the grass. She took the bread outside, and the birds gathered around her like she was Saint Francis, her palms open and full of crumbs. Mimi was surprised at the woman's communion with nature, but also how she stood with that particular posture of aging women, the rounding between the shoulders, the neck thrust forward, tortoise-like. When Mimi joined her outside, the birds scattered and became specks in the trees. I haven't been sleeping, Pat finally said. Neither have I, Mimi said. If I had a weapon, Pat said, I'd do better. A gun? Mimi asked. Do you think you'd really able to use it? I've always wondered if I could, if I had to. She pointed an imaginary pistol and pulled the trig. I'm not sure. Shush, Pat said. This is a silly conversation. Really? Mimi said. I'm just trying to get to know you some. Pat sighed. I don't see the point. The point, Mimi said, because it's just here in the end. We're the only ones. That's the fucking point, Pat. Watch your language, Pat said. Oh, for fuck's sake, are you serious? You're actually scolding me? If they went in different directions after this and never saw each other again, that would be okay. Why couldn't the woman give up a single thing? I'm most afraid that nothing matters anymore, Pat said to Mimi's back. Not what I've done with my life or what I was planning to do or all those things I thought were so important. I would have made other decisions if I'd known. What could Mimi say now to something so obvious but also so surprisingly gentle? She wondered if the woman had ever doubted herself before, had ever wished she'd made a different decision. I just don't know what to do with the fact of nothing in front of me. Why finish a book if you know the ending, Pat said. I don't know what I'm meant to do now. You don't have to do anything, Mimi said. You just have to live. What choice do you have?
Beautiful. And yes, who the hell doesn't like pudding?
Yeah.
Yannick Murphy is our final reader. She's the author of the novels The Call, Signed, Matahari, Here They Come, and The Sea of Trees. Her story collections include Stories in Another Language and In a Bear's Eye. And I would think that she would be 400 years old to have written all of those books. But here she is. She's a recipient of various awards, including the Pushcart Prize, the Thomas Winship Penn New England Award, a Whiting Award, and a National Endowment for the Arts Fellowship. Wow. This is The Water, her most recent novel, was called by Publishers Weekly obscenely suspenseful. And yes, and Dave Eggers said, while being one of our most daring and original writers, Yannick Murphy is first and foremost an exquisitely attuned observer of human behavior. Her characters are so richly imagined and believable that when you're finished with her book, you expect to find her characters' names in the phone book. Murphy's work provides pretty much unexceeded reading pleasure. Welcome to Yannick Murphy.
Thank you. Thank you, Michelle. These are great readings. This is too much fun. I'm having fun. Get somebody else up here to read so I can sit back and listen. This may be the most improvisational reading you'll hear today because I don't have my reading glasses. Let's see if I remember what I wrote. And if I don't remember what I wrote, I could just make it up. Maybe it'd be even more interesting. This book has a serial killer in it. And since I thought, well, he's not going to work in a panel about relationships. You might not really get to know my serial killer, but he's really worth getting to know. So anyway, I'll just start off in a section of the book, and I'll look for Santiago to hold up the sign that's telling me you're reading way too long. This is you at home at night after the meat, hanging up towels, wet and smelling like chlorine. And this is you with Sophia and Alex, looking at the swim videos you took of them earlier in the day, your girls stopping the frames now and then to see exactly where they started to slow down or when they reached out to touch the wall. They joke and make remarks like, I wasn't going to let the girl in the lane next to me win. I thought, this is my race, all mine, they say. This is you, later, looking at yourself in the mirror and hoping to see Chris in the reflection instead. Chris, who has the breasts she can wear with no bra, and the rear all the swim team dads stare at when they should be watching the race, their timing. You know you will never be like Chris. You look out the window at the moonlight on the trees and on the rock wall. It makes the rocks glow. It makes the trees appear as though their leaves are made of silver. You think about you, how if you were to describe yourself to someone, you would empty out your purse on the table. You would not have to say anything. Your chapstick that's never used will talk for you. Your receipts from another country close to the equator that for some reason you've left in there for almost a year will talk for you. Your picture of your friend from years ago will talk for you. The hairbrush with hair from not only your head, but also Sophia and Alex's heads will talk for you. Then you sit on your unmade bed, the bed you never make except before you're ready to go to bed, and you wonder who that someone would be who would want to know about you in the first place. You cannot think of anyone who would want to get to know you that well ever again. You wonder if your husband, Thomas, knows what you have in your purse, if he even has any clue. When he comes into your room to brush his teeth in the bathroom, you say, "Do you have any idea what's in my purse?" Thomas brushes his teeth for too long, you have always thought. He's going to abrade his gums, and someday they will peel away from his teeth like a pink strip of stretched out bubble gum that's already been chewed. He is brushing his teeth too long now, and of course not answering you because he is brushing his teeth. When he is finally finished, he rinses his mouth and then takes a long time dabbing at it with a towel that is still wet and smells like chlorine from when the girls used it after their races during the swim meet. If I were Chris, the swim team mom with the breasts and the rear, you think, I bet he would not wait so long to answer me. He would have talked through his brushing and his toothpaste foam to say in a mumble, yes, dear, no, dear. Apparently, though, Thomas never heard the question about your purse. I've got a great idea how to make money, Thomas says. Do you want to hear it, he asks. Thomas does not ever wait for you to answer his questions and starts telling you about his ideas anyway. This great idea is not so great, you think. He wants to develop a water gun that horse owners can use on dogs so that dogs don't endanger them when they're on horseback on the rural roads where you live. You think, why not just a regular water gun, the kind your daughter Alex has that blasts hose-sized streams of water more than 50 feet? You don't tell Thomas, though, that his great idea is not so great. Instead, you turn away from him in bed, facing the window where you can see the moon on the birch tree making its bark appear frozen white. This is Thomas in bed, lying next to you, patting your arm once before you fall asleep. Thomas has dispensed with the kissing. You think this happened 2 years ago when the work he does in his research lab started becoming more difficult, coincidentally around the same time your brother shot himself. There is too much worry for Thomas now, what with managing the other researchers and creating the antibodies that he sells. You think that where his lab is located adds to his stress. It's near the local commuter airport. And wouldn't the constant screech of tires hitting the tarmac and the smell of airplane fuel in the air run him down? This is you facing the wall, wondering if the kissing would make a difference. In the morning, would you love him any better because he kissed you on the lips? Would you love him any worse? This is you wishing hours later when he wakes up and makes his way to the toilet in the thick, cloudy darkness of night that he hadn't woken you up. This is the house whistling, the wind coming in through windows not all the way closed. This is you wondering if there is such a thing as wife energy, and if you had it, whether maybe you would love Thomas more. Maybe Thomas would be kissing you at night instead of patting you on the arm. If you had wife energy, he would be complimented more often. You would tell him how smart he is. You would tell him you like the way his hair looks when it grows long. You would tell him he did a fine job with the mower, that the fields look like golf courses. You would tell him he is funny instead of listening to funny things he says and not laughing out loud, just laughing inside, because the outside laughter takes energy, and you have used that energy up already. You have used it when listening to your teenage daughter call you names. You have used up your energy trying not to get angry, trying not to care, so that she eventually would stop. You have used up the energy reaching behind you while driving and grabbing a book from your daughters that they were fighting over. You have used it up closing a window. Yes, just a window, you thought to yourself while doing it. The window was heavy and hard to pull down. You had to put your back into that window. What was the use of all that swimming you did at the facility while your daughters were practicing if you could not even close a window? Okay, I'm gonna jump ahead. Let's see. So Annie is pretty PO'd because she's got this husband, obviously, who's doing the kissing thing. Okay, you wish you were at the facility now. If only you hadn't listened to Paul and gone on a walk with him. If you hadn't, you'd be in the water now, maybe working on improving your scapular plane of motion in the free by making sure you rotate a little on each side before lifting out your arm and making sure your elbow is pointed high in the air before you dive your fingertips back into the water to start your reentry. Paul moves closer to you now and takes you in his arms and starts kissing you again. The sun's gone lower in the sky, and you think that because it's darker now, maybe you're letting Paul kiss you harder, his fingertips more than just brushing your breasts, his body pressing into yours so that you can feel the concentration of the warmth of blood that's making him hard. It's the sound of crying that pulls you apart. Not a child's cry, but a woman's. She's calling for help. When you and Paul get to Dinah, she's on the ground, grabbing onto her ankle. I can't stand up, she says. Paul pulls off her shoe to get a closer look. Her ankle, with her skin so white, looks like a large puffball mushroom, the kind that have been cropping up every morning on your front field because the weather's been damp. What happened? Did you just trip? You ask her. Yeah, stupid me. This never should have happened if I hadn't been walking with my hands in my pockets. Oh, my phone. Is my phone all right? Dinah moves her body so she can reach into her pocket, but when she does, her ankle moves, and she sucks in her breath. "I'll get it for you," you say. "No," Dinah says. But you have already reached into Dinah's pocket for her and slid the phone out. When you turn it on for her to see if it's still working, the photo of you and Paul kissing is on the screen. "The picture doesn't matter," Dinah says. "Even if you erase it, I'll just tell Thomas and Chris I saw the two of you together." "What? Let me see that," Paul says and grabs Dinah's phone. "You're spying on us," you say. "You always think everything's about you, don't you, Annie? Well, wrap your brain around this. I didn't come out here to spy on you. I came out here to get some exercise, and then I saw the two of you swapping saliva like some teenagers." Paul deletes the photo. "Come on, Annie, let's go," he says, grabbing your hand. "We can't just leave her here," you say. Paul tosses Dinah's phone next to her hand on the ground. "She's got her phone," Paul says. "She can call whomever she wants to come help her." Walking back to the facility, you can't even answer Paul's question when he asks you if you're all right. You're feeling the familiar feeling all over again, the glistening road, wet from the misty weather, threatening to crack open and suck you down into an abyss you'd never be able to crawl your way out of. But you're with Paul, and thinking about your brother isn't supposed to happen when you're with Paul, or thinking about Paul. How is this happening? Thomas, you think, would not listen to Dinah even if she did approach him with the news. You even think how at first he would probably tell you that Dinah started babbling all the way to him about you and Paul, and that he didn't believe her, thought the pressures of being a swim team mom were becoming too much for her, especially now that her daughter is not winning any more of her races. Thomas would tell you that he felt sorry for Dinah, having to make up such low stories about you and Paul. Thomas, if you don't say anything to ruin it, might never even believe Dinah, and you could carry on as usual, no matter what absurd stories she may tell him. Because that's what it is, absurd, a grown woman kissing her friend's husband in the woods. This is the facility, the light coming in from the hall, tall windows above the entrance, now a little darker, the sun close to setting. This is you going up to the front desk, telling them there's a woman on the upper trail at the reservoir who probably sprained her ankle so seriously she will need medical treatment, a clinic, a doctor, some x-rays to make sure nothing's broken. These are your daughters coming out of the showers after practice, their hair dripping wet at the ends, creating water stains on their shirts above their small breasts. These are the girls saying almost immediately when they see you, "We're hungry, what's for dinner?" This is Sophia saying, "Sounds god-awful," when you tell her falafel with tahini dressing. This is you not feeling up to driving home just yet and seeing Thomas. "I've changed my mind, let's order pizza," you say. These are the girls cheering in the parking lot as they're walking to the car. "Saved by pizza," Alex yells. Thank you.
So now we have a little time to take questions from the audience, and there's a microphone up here if you want to come up to the microphone to ask a question. No questions. So we have some rather violent relationships in these books. I normally think that sometimes women aren't always allowed to write violence, or they're not expected to. You're not in your head. Do you want to answer that and talk about that?
I do think particularly female characters are not supposed to be judgmental, selfish, have violent tendencies, talk about hate. And I think that if you are writing characters and you don't allow them that the full range of that emotion, that you're really sort of shortchanging them. And it's not that they have those thoughts or impulses, it's what they do with it that essentially matters. And I think it's part of the question that continues to come up, particularly for women writers, is whether the characters are likable or not. and some sense that female characters need to be likable, they need to be good friends.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. Rita, who you met in the short piece that I read, the mother, she grew up in poverty. She had no mothering herself. She doesn't always make the greatest decisions. And it's very interesting to me the question of whether she's a good mother or not. I started to think that mothers are frequently held to a higher standard than fathers are, certainly. I completely agree with that.
Well, I think it's interesting that people think I have to like the character. I remember years ago I took a course with James Baldwin, and I started, this was in college, and I started reading, and he said, but I don't like the character. He's mean to his wife. And I was sitting there, and, you know, James Baldwin, I love James Baldwin, but I couldn't figure out for the life of me, why is it necessary that you have to like my character in order to have a connection with them? And it's always, I think it's a dicey area, because you're always thinking to yourself, if I show you my character's true nature, isn't that enough? Can't I bring you in as a reader enough, close enough to what I'm writing, that you can start, you know, feeling this connection? And I think that a lot of the women characters we write about, well, from my point of view, they come from me. So if I'm disgruntled and I've got a character who's going to complain about having to do the dishes, well, nobody wants to read about that particular character. You know, they want your character to be the shining angel, because they want to be perceived that way. The reader, in some essence, always wants to be perceived that way. So before I keep blabbing on, that was my thought about
it. Oh, that's good. Any questions out from the audience? Okay, we'll just... Oh, yes, please. No? Okay, she's moved, and so I thought she was going to ask a question.
There's a question out there.
Oh. Yes. Right back.
Well, you know, a fewness is a muchness, you know, so the less you know about a serial killer and you want to write about them, I think is the better, because then you have to start using your imagination. I mean, the only thing I ever knew about serial killers is what I read about them, and people always seem to, put them in a certain pigeonhole and say, well, they've had problems with their parents, obviously, and they've had, and I thought, well, you know, what if there's a serial killer out there who doesn't fall into all of these categories? What if it's just someone who doesn't even want to be caught? Because everything I read about serial killers was that they want to be caught. So I went in that direction. Just not knowing about the serial killer was enough to get my imagination going, to imagine being. And really, writing from a serial killer's point of view is sometimes a lot easier than writing from a woman's point of view, who I thought a lot of people in the book didn't like. You know, so it was, in fact, easier at times, because it was easier to imagine being somebody so different.
That's such an interesting question. As a debut novelist myself, I struggled with that. I think one of the most powerful things we can do as writers, and also just as human beings, is we have this incredible ability to empathize with one another, and to imagine what it would be like to be somebody else, and it's it really is the writer's most powerful tool, and you know, it works. And I would say, If you're struggling with that question, don't be afraid to try to put yourself into your character's shoes.
But I think this also sort of ties into the first question about whether your characters are allowed to express these you know, less than pretty sides of themselves. And I think that even, I've never written about a serial killer, but I've certainly written about, certainly written about people that I have no idea about. And most often I write from a man's point of view, and I'm clearly not a man, because I think one of the things that you can always sort of focus in on is what is what we all have in common. And that is, you know, we don't want to do the dishes, or we're irritated by something, or we find something beautiful. And it's the sort of mundane aspects of life that, you know, create the affinity for the character. And, you know, serial killers are, of course, monstrous and horrible, but they're...
Mine does his laundry, you know, in the book.
I mean, it's just a person, too, with a particular hobby,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Other questions? Yes.
That's you. I don't know. I guess I'm not aware that mother-daughter poverty equals stereotype. I've always felt like characters should be both quintessential and individual. You should be able to picture them clearly, but they should also be their own selves. I hope that answers your question a little bit.
Jump in on the end of this, that it's all, not it's all, but to an enormous extent, it's about being specific, and it's about being idiosyncratic. And that they're, you know, the storylines or the situations, mothers and daughters and poverty or any of it is that the originality is not necessarily in the entire construct, but in the relationship of these two people to each other and to their situation. And that, if you get deep enough in a character, is always going to be different because everybody will have a different approach to everything.
That's what I meant to say. Yeah.
Other questions? Yep.
You mentioned that you write from a man's point of view. Would you elaborate on why and how you think that's different in terms of writing from a kid?
Well, I've really been trying to figure this out for many decades and through many hours of therapy, and I don't really have a very good answer, except that I think that when I started doing it, what it was allowing me to do was get a distance from being a woman. So I was observing a woman rather than being a woman, and that that really gave me a way to sort of approach what I was trying to do. I also think that men get shortchanged in fiction. I mean, that's a gross generalization, but that they are not always allowed on the page to sort of access, you know, for lack of a better word, their feminine side, the emotions that they may not admit out loud. And that interests me, because I think, you know, so many men are really closed off, and I mean, so many women are too, but, you know, we're sort of closed off, and getting in there is really what interests me.
Liz?
I always find myself believing that there's no real bad person out there, and that any, you know, just like you or I, they end up having so many different sides and emotions, and, you know, some of them valid, and some of them obviously you think this person's a real jerk. And I do have an antagonist in my book who, she's just a nosy Parker, and she wants everyone to play by the rules. And while I imagined her, I had to keep reminding myself, she's just like me, you know. She's going to be someone you're not going to like on certain days or certain hours. So as long as I keep going back in there and saying, okay, I need to show her at a moment of weakness so that all of you can relate to her, then I can put on the page someone more dynamic and true to life than just a, you know, cookie cutter cutout.
The antagonist is always, of course, in conflict with the protagonist, right? So it's, if the point of view is from the protagonist, then what's interesting is the protagonist changing feeling about the relationship with the antagonist, how they begin to see this person in a different light. And if they're willing occasionally to allow that, you know, teeny little glimmer of humanity, right? I mean, so I agree. I mean, there are no completely bad people. Well, we know a few, but, you know, for the most part, it's, you know, we're all sort of some good and some bad on, you know, any number of days. But that when an antagonist is all bad, then you have a really sort of stock, not completely believable character.
Yeah, I think what we're talking about is giving characters dimension so that they're not flat. That's something I struggle with because I work much like a painter in layers, and so I have to constantly go back in and, you know, put layers of levels to my characters and layers to them so that they don't turn out to be just flat cartoons.
Other questions? Yeah.
Well, for me, it's actually like getting to know somebody. So that when I start the story, by the time I get to the end, I know this person so much better than I knew when I began. That then on the second time around, I know them better, and the third time around. So it really is this, as Annie said, this sort of layering effect, and that. You know, it may sort of be a writing class trope, but I think that when you find that you can't figure out where your story is going, what should happen next, it's generally because you don't really know the character well enough. And that can only happen when you just spend a whole lot of time with this person, put them in lots of different situations.
I'm really jealous of you guys when I'm writing because I love to read. So for me, I need to start a story where I don't know the character, and I keep writing and go, ooh, look what my character did. What's my character going to do next? So I try not to deny myself that feeling of, you know, what's going to come next, and I don't know anything about my characters sometimes. I think, you're broadly sure, I may pick someone I've met or seen or had conversations with to put in the book. But what they will do in the situations I put them in is always a mystery to me. So I don't know the endings of my books, for example. That would just be a real killjoy for me.
You know, actors, as I would imagine, writers work in different ways. Some actors go from the inside out. They have to know the inside of the character first until they, you know, and then other actors, and I'm blanking on it. It's called method acting, I think, where you work from the outside in. And personally, that's how I work. The sort of details of the visual details come first, and then I work from the outside in. So, and I think that's a very personal decision for writers and for actors to make, which way they want to work.
All right, that's all the time we have, but you can continue to ask them questions downstairs where they're selling their books. Thank you so much for coming.